This is an ABC podcast.
Did you know that university cheating is a $300 million a year global industry?
Contract cheating is where you might buy an assignment over the internet. You tell them exactly the sort of assignment you're after. You pay an amount of money, might be $100. And in as little as a few hours, they can turn around an assignment to the specification that you ask for.
Shortly, we'll hear about the federal government's draft bill that imposes a 2-year jail sentence for providing or advertising an academic cheating service. Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. First to a High Court decision that raises very difficult questions about the consumer rights of Indigenous Australians who live in remote communities. Lindsay Cobelt ran a general store in the far north of South Australia. And last week, a majority of the High Court dismissed the idea that Lindsay Cobelt's business practices were unconscionable. Dr. Heron Loban is based at Griffith University Law School. A Torres Strait Islander woman, Heron recently completed a PhD on consumer Indigenous issues. Heron Loban, this store, it was in the town of Mintabee. Where exactly is that?
So Mintabee is located in the far north of South Australia. It's about 1,000 kilometres from Adelaide, and it's in a particular area in the APY lands, which are Aboriginal lands, over a lease that's currently held by the South Australian government. So it's not in an Aboriginal community. It's a community where you have a mix of both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people and businesses living.
And this store, Nobby's General Store, run by Lindsay Cobelt, tell me about the book-up arrangement that Lindsay Cobelt had with his Indigenous customers.
It's a type of informal credit. In this particular case, it was consistent with the normal way that BookUp operates, that Nobby's Mintabee General Store, run by Mr. Cobelt, offered a range of goods such as groceries, fuel, and in particular, his business also sold secondhand cars. When an Anunga person from APY lands, from usually one of two remote communities, Mimali or Indulkana, came into Mr. Cobelt's store, if they wanted to buy some groceries or they wanted to buy a secondhand car, they could access this form of informal credit called BookUp. In order to access that, they would have to give Mr. Cobelt their bank card, which was called a key card throughout the case, which is a debit card, and also give him their personal identification number, so their PIN. And he would retain both the card and the PIN as part of that informal BookUp credit arrangement.
So what would happen when Centrelink payments or wages were paid into the accounts of these customers?
Yeah, so one of the practices that he did say he had, and it's reported in the decision, is that he would ask the Anunga person as part of the BookUp arrangement how much income they received, on what day their payments went in. And you have to appreciate the court was in agreement that almost all, if not all, of Mr. Cobelt's BookUp customers, who were Anunga persons, were impoverished. So they were on Centrelink. They were generally illiterate, innumerate, and had very low, if negligible, levels of financial literacy. So what would happen is that he would identify the day they would receive their Centrelink payment into their account, and usually just after midnight, sometime between 12 midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning, he would go in and he would withdraw 50% or up to 100% of their money and place that into his account as part of that BookUp arrangement.
To pay down on the debts that they had previously accrued.
That's right.
What records were kept under this arrangement? So you bought a secondhand car, that's thousands of bucks.
The arrangements were not in writing. There was nothing given in writing to the Anunga person. There were no receipts that were kept. There were no invoices that were issued. Only in more recent times he started to keep records of the car loans that he was giving. But even then, the court has said in its decision that two qualified accountants tried to look over the books that Mr. Cobelt kept around the BookUp arrangements and were unable to decipher what was owed, what had been paid, and what was still left owing.
So some years ago, ASIC, our corporate regulator, took action against Lindsay Cobelt, arguing that these arrangements were unconscionable. What were they alleging?
The main question that ASIC was putting generally at the federal court and then again at the full federal court and then ultimately the high court, was whether the various factors around the arrangement, so the vulnerabilities or the disadvantage of the Aboriginal people, the Anunga people, and also the book-up arrangement or the book-up system itself, whether that amounted to a systemic form of unconscionable conduct. So more or less whether Mr. Cobalt took advantage of his stronger bargaining position, of the vulnerabilities or the disadvantaged position of the Anunga people who ultimately became book-up customers, and used that to his commercial advantage in a way that was viewed as unconscionable by the law.
The federal court at first instance agreed with ASIC. They fined him, I think, $167,000. That decision was overturned when he appealed to the full federal court. So ASIC said, let's go to the High Court. And last week, the majority agreed with the full federal court and found that Lindsay Cobalt had not broken the law. What did the majority of the High Court of Australia find? And it was a 4-3 decision. We'll come to the three in a moment. What did the four find?
Overall, the majority found, when looking at this particular issue of the voluntariness, if you like, of the entry by the book-up customers into the book-up arrangements with Mr. Cobalt, they said that there wasn't a contravention of the unconscionable conduct provisions within the ASIC Act. And in particular, the majority relied on and used the evidence of an anthropologist, Dr. Martin, in a very particular way. They said that there were two cultural issues that were referred to by Dr. Martin, who was engaged by ASIC, which went to this issue of the voluntariness. So the first one was demand sharing. So they said this cultural aspect of demand sharing, which was explained by Dr. Martin as meaning the obligation that Anunga people have to one another, whereby if somebody has some money or somebody has something, then they can, in a sense, demand a share of that. And the cultural obligation of the person that has the money or the item is that they have to share that.
This book-up system offered some protection to Anunga individuals who had money because they weren't, you know, handling the money directly themselves, and therefore they couldn't be, I think the term is humbugged or hassled by their friends and family to share that money.
Yes, that's right. But there seemed to be only one person in the High Court's decision that said that was the specific reason as to why they used the book up. So that was somewhat interesting in terms of the majority.
That argument was acknowledged but put to one side by most of the judges. What was the other element or idea which was in this anthropologist's report that they looked at?
The other cultural aspect was this idea of the personalisation of transactions. They said that Anunga people like to engage in transactions, even commercial type transactions, in a personal way. So the relationship that they formed with Mr. Cobalt had that personalisation aspect to it, and that he was in fact acting as a sort of, the term was used in the decision, was broker. And that again was something that was unique to the Anunga people and perhaps to Aboriginal people more generally, and that affected their consideration of the voluntariness of the entry into the book-up arrangement.
There was also discussion about the fact that if people weren't happy with this, they could say, I want my card back, I want to end this relationship. The majority were saying, look, this is a voluntary relationship, people are not forced to be in it or stay in it.
That's right. The majority also said that the people that used the book up did have a basic understanding of the way it worked, that they were able to access a credit in circumstances where there was no other credit available, or they wouldn't otherwise be able to get the credit or get those goods, groceries, fuel, or the car. And so in that sense, that was a voluntary element that was part of their consideration as well.
Okay, so you've got the majority, four judges have sort of said no problems here, nothing to see here, there's no illegality, there's no unconscionability. Three judges say, whew, no, there are problems.
It was almost as if the judges used the same evidence and came at it from diametrically opposed points of view. And I should say there was a joint judgment with Justice Nettle and Gordon, and then there was a single judgment by Justice Edelman. So the minority also focused on issues of voluntariness, and in particular there was an interesting point of law made by Justices Nettle and Gordon, who said, and I'm quoting from the judgment here, that unconscionable conduct can be found even where the innocent party is a willing participant, But the question is how that willingness or intention to participate was produced. So in other words, they were saying that when you're looking at voluntariness, you need to look at all of the context, all of the circumstances, and all of the matters that are relevant that sort of feed into that relationship or that particular arrangement.
If you're illiterate and innumerate and you've never been exposed to or very few other kinds of forms of transactions or commercial relationships, the fact that you engage in this relationship doesn't necessarily mean that it's voluntary in a meaningful way. Is that what they're arguing?
Yeah, that's right. This is not looking at the Anunga people or the Aboriginal customers in a paternalistic way. It's simply a proper consideration of how unconscionable conduct should be viewed, that you look to the circumstances of the parties and you consider all of those circumstances and all of that context and determine based on that whether there has been some advantage taken by, in this case, Mr. Cobelt, as against his book-up customers.
The judges all look to this anthropologist's evidence and they're all talking about agency and culture and they're coming up with diametrically opposed views about what agency and what culture is. Are you surprised by that?
Look, to be honest, I am quite surprised by that. And part of my surprise comes from a number of these of matters involving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have come before the federal court with reference to unconscionable conduct and consumer protection. And the courts have found that issues around literacy, numeracy, financial literacy, commercial acumen are relevant circumstances, and they do go to usually a finding that there has been unconscionable conduct where those particular characteristics are present in the arrangement or in the consumer transaction. I think the other thing is that, for example, the majority referred to the fact that we have a highly unusual market, and that's the words used in the judgment, in respect of Minterby. The concern there is that are we applying a different standard of behaviour and conduct and what is unconscionable when we're talking about remote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities compared to the wider population? And it seems that that's what the majority was saying. And that is cause for concern, because how then do we give Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people agency now that we know that that will not always be viewed as a vulnerability?
How common are these book-up systems in remote communities around Australia?
Yeah, look, they're not uncommon. Even in places like Cairns, I know that there are book-up systems where there are high densities of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander populations in certain suburbs. And it's something that most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are familiar with, this idea of book-up in remote and regional Australia. But there's a couple of points that I would make, and the first one is that one of the observations of the minority was that there's nothing wrong with book-up per se, but it's the way that Mr. Cobelt operated his book-up and the way that he ran it. That book-up can be run in a way where it's not seen to be exploiting or taking advantage of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander customer. And the second thing I would say is that the High Court, in suggesting that book-up is a common practice in remote Aboriginal and also I know Torres Strait Islander communities, said that there was a cultural element to it. But in fact, I know from my research and my study from my PhD that the origins of book-up are actually entrenched in issues of race and the legislation that we had around protection and regulation from the late 1800s through to the 1900s, where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's money was controlled and regulated, and if they wanted to have something, they would have a credit at the store. From my own research, the book up that we have now is really a colonial artefact and a result of that quite racially discriminatory legislation that we saw 100 or so years ago that has left people in many ways lacking the financial literacy skills to advocate and protect themselves.
Well, I suppose part of that whole historical inheritance we have is that many Indigenous people are economically marginalised and at a low socioeconomic level, and that means people would argue that they don't have access to credit, and this is a way of them getting access to goods and services on credit that they wouldn't otherwise get. And I think that was one of the arguments of Lindsay Cobalt's lawyers, that he's giving options to people who might not otherwise have them.
You know, my own view and the general view of ASIC as the regulator and financial counsellors and others is that book-up shouldn't be immediately outlawed, that there is definitely a place for book-up that acts as a form of safe credit, you might say, that isn't exploitative, that isn't predatory. So there's a benefit and a balanced relationship between the business that's providing the credit and obviously derive some benefit from that, and then as well as the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander person who can access credit that they otherwise couldn't access. And I think the other point that I would make is that although we're talking about communities that are impoverished and people that are on Centrelink, over a sort of a 2.5 year period as identified in the case, Mr. Cobalt withdrew almost $1 million from the accounts of his book-up customers related to the sale of the second-hand cars. So although we're talking about people who are impoverished and are, as you say, financially marginalised, once you collect all of those different book-up arrangements and put them together, the system could be viewed as quite profitable when you look at it in that wider sense.
I'm still at a loss to understand, if there are no records being kept, how do you know when you've paid off your debt?
Yeah, that was certainly something that was considered by all of the judges and in all of the judgments, was this tying effect, that one of the things that BookUp does and one of the aspects that is quite troubling is that people don't know when they're out of the red and in the black, because there's a cyclical nature to the relationship whereby you book up and you buy something and then the relationship is kind of embedded in the system, and so you just keep making purchases and keep going into debt and keep making purchases and paying them off, and there isn't any really clear or obvious way to exit the book-up system, and in particular the way that the book-up system operated here in this case with Mr. Cobalt, where he had physical control over people's cards and their pins.
I guess this case just throws into sharp relief a lack of financial skills or financial opportunities for people in remote communities. How best can that bigger issue be addressed and tackled so these sorts of cases don't come before the courts?
I suppose the answer really is that we need to empower Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people through financial literacy, skilling and training. And that training does need to be culturally tailored to the community and the commercial context. So what I mean by that is the financial literacy training that you might deliver or give to Anangu people would probably look quite different from the type of financial literacy training that you might give to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living in Cairns, for example. There also needs to be some law reform around book-up that seems to be quite clear that has come out of the decision. Financial institutions also need to consider a little bit more how they can better service their Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander customers who do live in remote Australia, as we saw with the Anangu people, and whether they have appropriate products or services, and if they do, whether those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander clients know about those services. So I think that's a really important part too, that the regulator and the law needs to do a bit more work, as does the financial sector as well.
Dr. Heron Loban from Griffith University Law School, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you.
Dr. Heron Loban, a Torres Strait Islander woman who recently completed a PhD on Indigenous consumer issues. I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to the Law Report. We all know that Australia's tertiary education sector is huge. We have around 1.5 million students. A third of them are fee-paying international students. It's worth about $40 billion annually. But running side by side this crucial industry is another lucrative business, contract cheating. That's where students pay others to do their assignments or even sit their exams. The federal government is proposing new laws that would make it an offence to provide or advertise academic cheating services. If found guilty, offenders could go to jail for up to 2 years or be fined up to $200,000. I'm joined by Anthony McLaren. He's the CEO of TEXA, the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency. And I'm also joined by Associate Professor Philip Dawson. He's the Associate Director of the Centre for Research in Assessment and Digital Learning. It's known as CRADL. Anthony McLaren, if I can start with you, how big a problem is cheating at our universities?
That's a really difficult question to answer. And the reason is that a lot of what we know about the volume of cheating depends on self-reporting by students. So the figure that is given in our good practice guide on preventing contract cheating is between 6 and 8% of students. But I think all these estimates need to be treated with caution.
It could potentially be a lot higher than that.
It could be.
So, Philip Dawson, what forms does university cheating take?
So you can cheat at university in so many different ways these days. The sort of contract cheating that Anthony was talking about is where you might buy an assignment over the internet. You tell them exactly the sort of assignment you're after. You pay an amount of money, might be $100. And in as little as a few hours, they can turn around an assignment to the specification that you ask for. Now, it's not just that as well. We've seen things like exam impersonators, people that will go in and sit an exam for you. There are services that will offer to sit online exams for you. We also know that a significant chunk of cheating services are actually provided by friends, family, partners, students' peers.
So it sounds like there's a spectrum in terms of the kinds of cheating, but also the providers. But there are also, what, some big commercial industrial operations?
Absolutely. There's a few figures on how big the industry is, but the best figures I've seen are, say, $300 million Australian dollars a year. We do know that these are organised businesses, a lot of them. They train their staff. Quite ironically, they train their staff in academic integrity, in how to reference and all those sorts of things. So it is a big business, but also on the other hand, it's also happening in households and living rooms.
And Anthony McLaren, these big commercial outfits, where are they based? Are they based in Australia or are they based overseas?
Most of the ones that we've seen so far are based overseas. And the use of IT means that it can cross boundaries.
We do have a hunch that they are in India, China, certain African countries. The way that global labour markets work is there are some places where you can get a very highly capable English language speaking workforce for quite cheap. And that's where we think those operations are.
Do we know if they target foreign fee-paying students here in Australia and in other markets?
Yeah, look, a walk around a university campus will tell you that you'll see a bunch of signs in a bunch of foreign languages advertising these services, and you won't know it until you have a student point it out to you.
Really? So they're quite pervasive?
Absolutely.
Philip Dawson, you work at Deakin University, and I think back in 2016, something like 13 engineering students were expelled from university when they were found to have cheated. So presumably, if you get caught out as a student, you can be kicked out. But what happens currently to the people who've actually provided them with the cheating services?
At the moment, nothing happens to people who provide cheating services.
All right. So the federal government has drafted legislation that will make contract cheating an offence, right? It will make it an offence to advertise or to offer these sorts of services. There'll be, I believe, up to a 2-year prison sentence if you're found guilty or a fine of $200,000. Some pretty stiff penalties.
Yeah, that's certainly the proposals in the bill at the moment.
Philip Dawson, do you think that this is a good idea, this idea of making it a criminal offence to cheat?
I guess, first off, I don't think it's a good idea to make it a criminal offence. I don't think it's actually going to be very effective. The particular thing that I'm worried about is laws that make students passing notes in an exam or a parent offering to do the reference list for a child's assignment, that make that a criminal offence. I think we've got better tools to deal with that than criminalising things.
Well, look, I think we currently have an exposure draft of the bill, and the whole purpose of that is to gather comment on the drafting. So my reading of the bill, as it stands at the moment in its draft form, is that it's very clear that the target is the use and promotion of academic cheating services. There are references to students in there, but they're references, if you like, to positioning the provision of the services. You know, there are recipients of the services, and they are generally going to be students. So I don't share that concern.
Australia's looked overseas to see what other jurisdictions have gone down this path, and I understand that there are laws in New Zealand, and I think there are laws in something like 17 US states, including New York, Massachusetts, California, Florida, Texas, the big major places where we think of the major universities. Philip Dawson, how have these laws worked in those jurisdictions?
That's actually a really hard question to answer because there's very little evidence about effectiveness of these laws as a deterrent or as a way to punish people who have done the wrong thing. In some of the US states, the legislation goes back to the 1970s.
Have there been any cases that we know, any prosecutions that we know?
There have been. There more in the handful territory than in the routine territory. There was one high-profile case in New Zealand recently where a cheating service was found, and this is one that operated in New Zealand. It was going to be taken to court, but I believe they ended up settling out of court with the police for a substantial sum of money in the order of millions of dollars.
Well, that suggests these laws do have some teeth, at least for the domestic providers.
Yeah. Look, it suggests that there has been a time when one of these services was caught. We know that the domestic providers are not the big providers. We know most of it's overseas. We know there are many hundreds, thousands of these sorts of providers. So a high-profile case against someone who made the mistake of operating with their real name, to me, doesn't seem like a deterrent against the real bad guys who are doing this all anonymously, in secret, overseas.
Anthony McLaren, there are concerns that on the one hand that the laws are draconian, but on the other hand that they're perhaps toothless.
Yeah, that interesting paradox there. But look, I think that, there was a successful prosecution in New Zealand. There have been other prosecutions. There's been action taken in other places under other laws as well. And there's been some success in the UK in terms of campaigns to block access on social media to adverts for these kinds of services. There was a petition there that gathered thousands, tens of thousands of signatures urging the government to consider legislation. The Republic of Ireland at the moment is in the middle of passing legislation on this issue. But I do want to emphasise, no one I think thinks this is the complete answer to cheating or breaches of academic integrity. This is one response to target some particularly exploitative, illegal or to be illegal operations which are exploiting students and making a lot of money in the process.
At what stage finally are these draft laws?
The exposure draft is out there for comment by the 28th of June from all interested stakeholders. So all comments, suggestions are very welcome.
Anthony McLaren, CEO of TEXA, the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Agency, and also Associate Professor Philip Dawson, who's the Associate Director of the Centre for Research in Assessment and Digital Learning at Deakin University. Thanks so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you.
Thanks, Damien.
Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer Richard Gervin. That's it for the Law Report this time, but don't forget we're a podcast and you can access all our programs anytime, any place. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.